Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin Chapter. Dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences. Itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
The science of murder.
Internal organs appear healthy. No signs of trauma or disease. Heart muscle is free of scarring and necrosis. And there's no evidence of any cardiac event.
Healthy young men like this don't simply drop dead for no reason.
I concur, which is why I am still looking.
CSI and its various TV spin-offs have popularized and even glamorized the people who work in crime labs. But the very idea that lab scientists could have anything to do with catching a killer is a fairly new idea. As science writer Deborah Blum points out, forensic medicine didn't even exist 100 years ago. But in the 1920s, two heroic New Yorkers came along and changed everything, basically inventing the science of forensic medicine. It's a remarkable story, which Blum tells in her book, The Poisoner's Handbook. She tells Anstrain Champs that the story begins in the late 19th century, the golden age of arsenic, when poisoners got away with murder.
They were everywhere. I mean, they used arsenic and red lead to color candy. There was actually one woman in Pennsylvania who gave her ex-boyfriend a wedding cake with poison in the frosting. People thought about it, and they believed in a way that we don't believe today, that you can get away with it.
Well, contrast that history where people were, contrast it with where we are today.
We live in an age in which we take for granted that scientists will partner with the police in solving crimes. We know when there's a crime, there's going to be a forensics person out gathering fibers, analyzing them, fingerprints, blood types, toxicology. We take for granted that that's part of crime scene investigation. Less than 100 years ago, that did not exist.
Oh.
Right?
Well, it's also a time of great political corruption, right?
Yes.
Tammany Hall was in power, and going back to the role police played in trying to catch poisoners, coroners were, many of them, very corrupt.
And if you took New York as an example, Tammany Hall, as you say, was a corrupt and extremely powerful political machine. And the golden rule there was that you got an appointment if you had done Tammany Hall a favor. So I actually went and looked at who were coroners of the time, and they were sign painters and they were funeral home directors. But there were a few doctors, and they were disasters. The chief coroner of New York was a guy named Patrick Reardon, who had lost his practice after he'd killed too many patients, and who was such, really, a notorious alcoholic, he had to hire two assistants to hold him upright at crime scenes, right? He could not even stay sober. So you found that the police are saying, do not let the coroner's office near us, because they're always screwing up the case.
Well, onto this stage,
yes,
walk your two heroes, the fathers of forensic toxicology, Charles Norris and Alexander Gettler. Who were they?
They, to me, are especially heroic because they're civil servants, two underpaid scientists working in an underfunded laboratory in the city of New York. Norris was the first trained medical examiner in New York City. He came in 1918, and I've always thought he was perfect for the job because he was, you know, old-time East Coast establishment money of the Norrises, who founded Norristown, Pennsylvania. And he was absolutely fearless in taking the establishment on. And he hired the first forensic toxicologist in U.S. history to work for an American city. And that was a very different person. It was Alexander Gettler, who was a Hungarian immigrant who has put himself through school as a night ticket taker on a ferry, but shared with Norris this: he was absolutely obsessive, and he believed that chemistry could be used as a tool against crime.
Well, these two together pretty much invented this new science of forensic medicine, forensic toxicology. What was one of their first big breakthrough cases?
One of the most famous cases is a woman and her lover who conspired to kill her husband, and then they had taken out insurance policies on him, and they staged a fake break-in and burglary murder and then filed for double indemnity. And this case, the Snyder-Gray case, actually became, you know, the stuff of novel and movie legend. It was the foundation of the novel Double Indemnity. It actually played into James Cain's novel of Lovers and Murder and Betrayal, The Postman Always Rings Twice. But the catch was, when Gettler went and looked at it, he was able to prove that the man was completely unconscious, that they had, in fact, chloroformed him, given him mercury and alcohol, and he was able to track down all the toxicology that had gone into killing this man, and they were able to find where they had purchased it. You know, sensational murder cases like that. I was more drawn to kind of everyday cases that weren't so famous. Arsenic murderers, I really liked. There was some really fascinating carbon monoxide murders. One of my favorites, I do sound twisted, was one in which a man suffocated his wife, and then they had gas lighting. It's the early 1920s, broke a gas fitting, and the gas floods into this little poor tenement building. He's pretending it's an accidental death. Again, he'd taken out an insurance policy. Gettler walks into the room. He looks at the body. The body is pale. And if you know carbon monoxide, you know that a person who dies of carbon monoxide poisoning is not pale. They're going to be flushed pink. There's a chemical reaction in your blood that will make you flush, your skin flushes pink. He takes one look at this pale corpse and goes, no, this is not a carbon monoxide death. And when they go back to the morgue and look at her blood, they find instead another gas, carbon dioxide, in her blood. And that tells you that it's suffocation.
So what's the story of the science? Because there are wonderful dramatic stories about the poisoners, but for Alexander Gettler to get to the point that he can break down arsenic, tell you what kind it was, find it in a body, and then find additional chemical fingerprints,
right,
essentially. What were the scientific advances that he made?
You know, well, I should say that I really love the chemistry of the 1920s. It's what we think of now as wet chemistry. Back then, they literally were sloshing around in body tissue to figure this out. Gettler was the first person in the world to figure out how to tell if someone was drunk at time of death. I mean, he did phenomenal work looking at alcohol poisoning, for instance. And to get to the point where he developed a test where you could say this person in an auto accident was drunk when they died, it took him 6,000 brains.
6,000 brains?
6,000 human brains before he could work out that chemistry. What's the background chemistry of a normal brain? When he would run people through a test to see if they could stand up to the rigors of working in this New York chemistry lab, he kept a bucket of brains in the lab refrigerator, this kind of sloshy,
like Dr. Frankenstein,
icky.
A bucket of brains?
A bucket of brains. And one of the things that you had to do in the initial test to see if you were fit for the lab was go in, get both your hands in this bucket of brains, squash out some material, and take it over and run some tests over it. So you had to be pretty tough about this.
So let's bring this back up to the present. In our high-tech world today of gas chromatography and nanoparticles, is it still possible to poison somebody and get away with it?
Yes. It's much harder, I should say that first, and the majority of poisoners are caught today. Can you get away with it if you have a sloppy doctor, if they don't do the right tox screen? Yeah, you can.
So that's human error, but I guess what I'm asking is whether we've completed the science. Have we figured it all out?
No.
We can find any chemical in anybody's body and we know what the toxic chemicals are.
No. Do we understand every chemical going? Do we know the toxicology of every chemical compound out there? We don't. I mean, one of the things that is comparable in the 1920s to today is they were awash in a sea of industrial chemicals. We have that same kind of, do we understand everything going on today? I mean, if you look at, say, the toxic database of the EPA versus every chemical they've put through a rigorous test, we haven't done all of them. we're still sort of feeling our way around it. And it enables people not so much to go out and kill people, because most toxic compounds have at least some poison that we know something about. It's that it enables people to misrepresent and scare us about chemicals that aren't really that scary.
For instance, didn't Dr. Mehmet Oz say recently something about arsenic and apple juice?
Yes, and it made me personally crazy, because I'm a woman who obsesses about arsenic, right? So he did a crusade against arsenic levels in apple juice. It's not fresh apple juice. It's, you know, apple juice from concentrate. Now, arsenic's a naturally occurring element, so we have some minimal level of arsenic exposure all the time. So you get organic arsenic, inorganic arsenic. We metabolize organic arsenic really well. We're exposed to it all the time. It's in shellfish. It's in seaweed. We eat it. It goes through us. We're done with it. But we don't metabolize inorganic arsenic very well at all. And that is, in fact, the homicidal version. And what he did is he did a test and says, what's the total arsenic? And he didn't factor out or even separate out the organic. So you could have an apple juice sample that was really high, but it could be all organic. Mm. And you could have an apple juice sample that was really low, that was primarily inorganic and was much more dangerous. And so he takes something that is not particularly dangerous and freaks people out about it and adds to our general perception that, you know, that all chemicals are dangerous, that everything is full of toxic chemicals. The bottom line is we live in a chemical world. We're made of chemicals ourselves. We drink and eat and inhale chemicals every day. Air is chemical, in fact. And almost none of those things kill us, right?
That's Pulitzer Prize-winning science writer Deborah Blum talking with Anne Strainchamps. Her book is The Poisoner's Handbook, Murder and the Birth of Forensic Medicine in Jazz Age New York.